Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
It's been 13 years now since Massachusetts' first Black governor, Deval Patrick, signed the first proclamation commemorating Juneteenth in Massachusetts. Now, the Commonwealth will celebrate the day as an official state holiday this Saturday, also for the first time. Juneteenth, at its most elemental level, is a celebration, marking the day in 1865 that slavery came to an end in Texas. And of course, it's so much more than that, and we're going to dive into that powerful history with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Annette Gordon Reed. She is a professor at Harvard, the author of numerous books, and that includes her latest on Juneteenth. And as we do that, we'd love to invite you into this conversation. How will you celebrate Juneteenth? What does the day mean to you here in New England? Also, what questions might you have for Annette Gordon Reed? Call us. The number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Professor Gordon Reed, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Glad to be here.
So I know I gave the briefest of summaries of Juneteenth there in the introduction. So maybe you could beef that up for us a little bit. As a historian, what does Juneteenth mark?
Juneteenth marks June 19th, 1865, the day that United States Army General Gordon Granger came to Galveston, Texas, and issued General Order Number 3, which announced the end of slavery in Texas. And it was originally called Emancipation Day, but over the years, it became Juneteenth, and that's the way it's been celebrated for a very, very long time.
So now bring it here. Bring Juneteenth from Texas to New England. Why is something that started so locally elsewhere now so important locally here?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. As near as I have been able to determine, the holiday left Texas, came out of Texas as Texans moved away from the state. The Texas diaspora introduced the holiday to places and around the country. And I think there has been a hunger for some day to commemorate the end of slavery. Now, this is not the total end of slavery. It was a process of emancipation. But I think the combination of proselytizing by Black Texans in the diaspora and also this desire to recognize this advance in human rights, the end of chattel slavery in this particular place, it caught on with people. It's a summer holiday. It's a family day. It's a day for barbecuing and fun. And as sort of a lead up to precursor to July 4th, it fits with this desire to recognize the end of slavery.
In your book on Juneteenth, you make this connection with sort of the evolution of the holiday and your evolution, if I may, in your understanding of the state you grew up in Texas, mm-hmm. your understanding
yes.
of its history, our collective need to understand its history. That is, as you've said, where the first Juneteenth was celebrated. So let's dig into that a little bit. And I think the first question for you is, what was Juneteenth to you growing up in Texas?
Well, growing up, it was primarily a fun family holiday that I look forward to. It was a day of drinking as much red soda water as we could contain for kids. And that's basically pop, strawberry soda water, which is sort of one of the drinks that you're supposed to have some sort of red drink during Juneteenth. Eating barbecue, throwing firecrackers, lighting sparklers, just a day of fun. And as I got to be older, I understood more the serious nature of the holiday in the sense that it was something that you're commemorating the end of slavery. But as a kid, it was a mini family reunion and a time for community, you know, good spirits and good cheer.
Yeah. How do we make sense of that? This idea, as I'm hearing you talk about it, of something that is fraught with the import of history, but also for a child or a family, a moment of joy and celebration. As a historian, do we have a lot of those where it's both fraught and joyous? It's a big moment, and also it's just a small, intimate celebration.
Not many. Not many things. I'm trying to think about the fourth has a different valence to it. I mean, the fourth, I suppose, is the day commemorates the beginning of the United States of America and the American Declaration of Independence. Juneteenth celebrates the end of slavery in Texas, but we know that it was a very difficult time after that for the enslaved people, because they were doing this celebrating in the midst of people who had been their former enslavers, who were not so happy about all of that. So it was, I've said other places that it was a mixture of sort of hope and hostility, hope in the midst of hostility, that you don't typically think of July 4th. July 4th, we can say, well, the Declaration didn't live up to all of its promises and so forth, but the United States of America was formed. The country did become a country. With Juneteenth, slavery ended, but another series of travails began. So it's, you know, it's a happy day. We can't minimize how those people felt when they learned that legalized slavery, in which they were, you know, bought and sold, separated from their families, all those kinds of things, no longer existed. But we are also mindful of the fact that this was the beginning of another set of struggles that the freed people had to endure.
You know, you said hope in the midst of hostility, and then you talked about another round of travails. And we were saying that, you know, a lot of this book is about your childhood. It was fascinating to learn that you were a childhood trailblazer, that you integrated a white school before it was court mandated. Sorry, I have trouble saying that word. And I expected more of a story of hope in the midst of hostility in that experience. But in many ways, you were naive of the experience that was happening around you.
Well, I knew it was a momentous thing. I knew from the way people talked about it that this was a big deal. But I grew up in a town where when I went to the doctor, there were separate waiting rooms for white people and Black people. When I went to the movie with my brothers, we sat in the balcony. Black people had to sit in the balcony. So I understood the racial, I sort of experienced the living the way race, you know, was lived during that time period, even before I went to school. But I knew that there was something important about what I was doing. And I suppose I was, as a six-year-old, I wasn't aware of the worldwide implications of it, obviously, because I was of my age. But I was in a situation where I had a teacher, my first grade teacher, who was just wonderful to me. Some of the kids were nasty and some of the kids were nice. But I took all of that pretty much in stride. It was a difficult time in some ways, but I liked school. I liked learning things. I was a good student. And I don't wonder if I would have had a different time of it if I had not been a good student. In other words, if there had been other kinds of problems grafted onto the stresses of integrating a school. But for the most part, I would say I made it through without real trauma.
Listening out there, what questions do you have about the history of Juneteenth in Texas, what it means today? For historian Annette Gordon Reed, the number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So Annette, now we fast forward and your town celebrates you. There is a mural of you. There is a bust of you. They celebrate your Pulitzer Prize. They celebrate your Pulitzer Prize. How does it feel now to look back on that childhood, to be talking about our racial history in America, reflecting on things like Juneteenth, and now be celebrated in that very community?
Well, it feels good. I wish my parents were alive to see this. This would have meant a lot to them. But I'm also mindful of the fact that we still have a lot of problems. There's still issues in Texas and in other places about, voting, about what kind of history we can teach in schools. It's still, part of a struggle in lots of ways. I mean, we've had advances, obviously. The fact that people would honor me in that way suggests that things have advanced, but there's still issues. And so you know, I'm happy about it, but I'm also mindful of the fact that Texas and other parts of the country right now are going through a lot as we try to figure out in the midst of what people have called a racial reckoning, what direction the country is going to take.
Let's unpack that a little bit. One of the references you just made there in that answer was to struggles over what people can teach in schools. And I was struck in your book where you talk about the idea that people may complain about revisionist history, or have criticism, might be a better word, that as we do projects like 1619, as we begin to look critically at the history we've taught ourselves and the way slavery, for example, is missing from it, Black contributions are missing from it, that somehow that's revising. You say no, that's completion in the book. Talk a little bit more about that.
Yes, I mean, revisionist history, people use that term in a pejorative sort of way. But what they're not realizing is that history is always being revised constantly. Every good historian is a revisionist historian in the sense that new information comes to light and you have to write things differently in light of that, of the new information gleaned. Different people ask different questions about material. Some people could look at a document, say the Texas, the Constitution of the Republic of Texas, that has many provisions talking about race, in which they basically, the state has a full-throated support for the institution of slavery, which says that Black people, people of African descent, can't become citizens. They can't come to the state and reside there without permission, all those kinds of things. People could read that document. Some historians did read it, and they may not have thought anything about those provisions. But there's no way now that people looking at that document would not take note of those provisions and not see that it helped to shape Texas and shape Texans and their experiences in the state. So we're attuned to those things now, and we pay attention to them. And so history is always being revised because, as I said, every generation has its own questions about the past, and because we find out new things and we want to incorporate those new things into the story.
So let's bring that back home here again. You know, we're in New England. We love the opportunity here to talk about Plymouth. Last year on our show, we marked the 400th anniversary. I'm chuckling because you addressed that in the book, and I heard your chuckle about that, too. We marked the 400th anniversary of the Mayflower's arrival last year by looking more deeply into the history of the Indigenous people here then, here now. You talk about that narrative a bit in the book, why the narrative has persisted. Why has it that America started with the arrival of Puritan pilgrims here in 1620?
Well, it's a more uplifting, I guess, in some ways, but a more uplifting story about people coming to escape religious persecution. Communities, family, religion, all those kinds of things. But it's a more uplifting story than, say, Jamestown, which is a story where people are coming essentially to make money and where they very quickly began to institute a system of plantation of slavery. And, you know, Jamestown obviously is before Plymouth. And as I talk in the book, you know, Florida and St. Augustine is before both of them. Well, before both of them, the Spanish are here and doing all kinds of things. But Plymouth gives you if you leave out the Native American part, which people did for the longest period of time, other than the story of Thanksgiving, it's a better story than Jamestown, where people are just there to make money and there's no higher power, no higher thing that they're trying to recur to. So that's a preferable start to the narrative.
You know, you talk about that so often in the book, this idea that what we hunger for is the mythological story, the better story that we can rally around. And as a result, in our telling of stories and our sort of worshiping is too strong a word, but we'll use it for now, our worshiping of historical figures, we embrace an incomplete picture because it's a better story and it's less complex. What do we lose when we do that? You know, there's real implication to that in the stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves.
Well, because you lose reality, you lose a sense of what's really going on in a place. It's a bit of essential information. It's like you're trying to put something together, and there are ingredients that are missing from it. And here, you don't really know why certain things are happening. You don't have a sense of the origins of things. You know, it may not be. The stories of the past may not all be pleasant, and they're not always going to be present if you're dealing with them realistically, but at least they tell you the condition of your society. They give you a sense of why we are doing these kinds of things. And you can't help to fix, it's sort of hard to fix things if you don't know, really don't understand the nature of the problem. So mythology, and I do talk a little bit about this, and it's not just Americans who do this. All societies have their myths. And that sort of suggests that this may be something that we need at some level, but we also need history, and we have to be realistic about the past if we have any hope of figuring out who we are and doing better for the future.
You know, so I said at the very beginning of our conversation that the Commonwealth will celebrate Juneteenth as an official state holiday this Saturday for the first time. What is the potential of that in the moment we are in, a year after the murder of George Floyd, several years into protests again and reckoning again with our racial history? What is the potential for communities observing Juneteenth?
Well, the potential is that people will do what I was saying before. Think about how we got here. Why do we have these kinds of problems? Where did this come from? And people have to understand that Juneteenth, 1865, was not so long ago, really. Hmm. I mean, I knew my great-grandmother, who lived till I was about 11. Her mother had been born in slavery and had been freed as a child by her father, who owned her and her mother. My great-grandmother knew her. My grandmother knew her, and I knew them. So I know people who knew people who had been enslaved. And so these things are not so long ago. And I think Juneteenth, celebrating Juneteenth and thinking about that will help us sort of draw the lines, not one line, but to think about how we have arrived at a point where we have racial problems, that we have a system of racial hierarchy that we've been chipping away at for most of the 20th century and part of the 21st century through law and education and all of those things. And we've made some progress, but it would make us think about, we still have a way to go here. So this holiday invites us to think about the legacies of the past, and, you know, doing that in the summer. I know there will be celebrations, but it's also a time for education, which people are trying to do as well.
Annette Gordon-Reed is a university professor at Harvard, Pulitzer Prize-winning author. Her latest book is on Juneteenth. Professor Gordon-Reed, thank you.
Thank you for having me.